But there's a good man in town, but he runs too much. And also, it's okay for us to be quick and dirty. We have to be. I have the same problem as my physician. Well, he says something about comfort. Regarding the exhaustion of Oliver. And he mentions the exhaustion of Oliver. So, you know, always these guys who have spent so many years talking to so-called analysts who think they know Tom Carrick, who knows
I know, but
what I'm saying. Well, Tom and I have been in contact for 30 years. And Tom will tell you that he's the best researcher of all. Writing a piece of foreign affairs. And I'm going to say X and Y. Is it correct? I'm going to say you've got the wrong answer on. So, you know, a guy who has a piece of foreign affairs, too busy.
Non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero,
non
è vero, non è vero,
non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero, non è vero
although they're fat. I mean, it's just circumstances.
But, yeah,
next one will move with her next man. There's another one. What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that?
My name is Neil.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Lindsay.
Yeah.
Let
me show you how that is still going to
be. Yeah, I think it's going to be. So you come to the meetings every day? Yeah, because you've got a blind paper on the back.
So, who do you represent?
Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Honorable members, honorable members, if we can start. Thank you, honorable members. We have an invitation to attend a what is called a national indaba on the 1st and the 2nd of June. So we will be coming back to members to request them to attend. We are invited by the Deputy Minister of Home Affairs to discuss or to be part of the people that will be discussing the issue of combating child pornography. And this meeting will be held in Port Elizabeth, so I'll be coming to members to request their availability to attend to this important engagement. We have responded to the Deputy Minister and we've accepted his invitation, and that will send members of the committee to participate in that discussion. We also have a request for the around the 12th of June that we should host the. This request comes from. It's a letter written to the Speaker by the Minister of Intelligence, and the Speaker wrote to us requesting us to give it a consideration. That, just to read one paragraph, it says that there will be a visit by three or four Palestinian members of the KIS set. I don't know how to be to call this word properly, but the Israel Parliament. That will be the easier way to say it. The Israel Parliament. And they will be here between the 4th and the 12th of June, so the Speaker requests us to make available in our program the time to meet with them. So I'm just making members aware that when we amend the program, they should be aware that we are trying to accommodate some of these activities. We have a request. I've on behalf of the committee, indicated that we may not be able to fulfill this invitation. We've been invited by the Committee of Foreign Affairs of Colombia to visit and engage with them. But looking at the timing, I thought that we will not be able to deal with this invitation in our current term. Hopefully is that if we come back, we may have time to deal with it. If we don't, the new parliament will have to follow up on those invitations, outstanding invitations. With that note, honorable members, we requested Tim Hugh to come and discuss with us an issue that relates to what we call the challenges that militate against the unity of the continent. You'll be aware that currently we are facing difficulties as a country in relation to foreign nationals, and how we have responded both as the political community of this country, political leadership of this country, and how our people have responded to that particular challenge. However, that does not mean that we should not pursue the objective of uniting the continent. These are challenges that we may have to live with and continuously find a way to deal with them. But we may have to continue to seek to make sure that the continent is united. We've in the topic in your notice, it gives an indication that we'll only be discussing one aspect of that challenge, which is religion. However, I want to invite members that they should not be limited to that. They should look at all other areas that militate against this unity and be able to say how do we move forward and drawing from other experiences of other regions that have been able to come together. We are going to give Tim Hughes the time to make a presentation, but I'm going to invite members to make to ask questions, but also to make contributions. That Tim will not only be answering questions, but all other members are invited to answer those questions, to pose those questions and answer those questions. Tim will be given the opportunity to comment on all other issues, but we want to engage into a discussion rather than a question and answer session, into a discussion that will be able to express what we think and what we understand of those particular challenges. Tim will only work is just to set the vehicle moving, and members are then invited to engage in the thoughts that he will share with us, and to be able to express their own thoughts. Tim, you're welcome. You're used to this committee. I'm not going to introduce you. All members know you, and you have learned to know all of them on their first names. And you're welcome. Over to you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairs. As always, it's actually a privilege. It's a privilege to be here. Thank you for inviting Sire. It's always engaging. It's always challenging. The particular challenge that arrived on my telephone was delivered by Honourable Hajesh on Friday, and who said, Tim, I know it's short notice, but could you talk about some of the challenges or some of the mitigating factors against or challenging African unity? And before I could say no, I said yes. So what I've done is we have prepared a SIRE paper, a think piece, which has been reproduced for you, which is on an African Union government, some perspectives on an African Union government. That's a more reflective piece on institutional matters. And then, as if Honourable Sitoli could read my mind, what's left of it, I thought that all I would do today is to posit or present or float some challenging ideas, some challenging thoughts, that would stimulate debate, given that the topic is both it's timely, the issues it has become somewhat prescient, actually, but I want it to be reasonably controversial. If there's no other role that think tanks should play, then they should be challenging convention and received wisdom. So much of what I have to say is purely one form of common sense, which is there to be challenged. Honourable members, my assumption, my working assumption, however, is that you are all familiar with the Pan-African Parliament proposal on the Union Government of Africa, the draft report delivered or presented by the task force on April the 18th, 2007. If you don't have a hard copy, I have a hard copy here. And of course, my assumption as well is that you're familiar with the African Union study on an African Union government towards the United States of Africa. Again, I have a hard copy if members do not have them, but obviously these are online. Okie doke. I will be brief. Think tanks prattle on. I shan't. I'm going to whip through this, and I hope that we have a fruitful discussion. I have left the points and the slides at a very high level of generalization, simply to stimulate debate and discussion. I think that the first point that needs to be made is that some of the assumptions one reads as being dogma, almost, within the pronouncements of the AU, of committees, of summits, that it is a given that there will be African unity or a United States of Africa, or African unity is generally understood, or is understood to be a good and desirable thing. What is lacking is a thoroughgoing debate about what this concept of African unity means in all its iterations, and from our perspective, Sire's perspective, we think that the debate such as it has been held or had has operated generally at the level of political elites, and there has been insufficient debate, insufficient interrogation of the concept of African unity, of the different interpretations of what unity is or ought to be, how deep-rooted, how deep, how wide unity should be, indeed even the institutional structures. We had a similar sentiment, if you like, after the after MAP, after the NAI, and after NEPAD. You remember this committee, I think, only debated NEPAD. I remember President Mbeki launching it in Parliament on the 31st of October 2001, and I think that the committee had not considered it before, in fact, it was officially launched, as it were, by President Mbeki. So, in the first instance, has there been sufficient interrogation of this concept of African unity? Our contention is that unity isn't what it used to be. That the basis of African unity that was the founding premise, if you like, of the OAU is not the same conception of unity that is the founding premise of the African Union. Indeed, to some degree, the OAU sense of unity is a negative unity. It's a unity against colonialism, against occupation, against imperialism. With the founding premise of unity of the African Union is more positive, it's more forward-looking. It looks to development questions, it looks to NEPAD, it looks to the MDGs. It's a different sense of unity. It's more progressive, it's more textured, it's more developmental. And I think we need to look at that a little bit more carefully as well. I think it's a very positive thing in that sense. I've made the point that the case for unity has not been popularized, nor has it been made persuasively to all Africans. There is very little evidence out there. In fact, I cannot find any empirical evidence for the desirability of a United States of Africa on anything like a representative basis. I haven't seen polls, I haven't seen referenda. We're far away from referenda, I understand that. But the voice of rank-and-file Africans, whether they're unions, civil society, truly there are fora for this type of debate, but I feel that sometimes the debate has gone ahead of the 900 million people that live in our continent. Let me state the very, very obvious and move on to something perhaps more interesting. But the very obvious is that it's highly challenging. If we have the EU with 27 countries, and it's taken the EU effectively 60 years to get to this state, we have our 53 countries, five time zones, at least five time zones. For any of you who've traveled within the DRC, you'll know that it takes 5 hours, 4 to 5 hours to travel from tip to flying. The diversity of states, nation states in Africa, is like no other part of the world. It is like no other continent, from Mauritius through to the massive countries, the massive states of Sudan and Algeria. Africa is also delineated by regionalism. It has regional features that have historically differentiated one from another. This may be geographic, be it the Sahara, it could be cultural, ethnic, racial to some degree, climatic, in terms of production patterns as well. We are an extreme, the tapestry of Africa is a huge challenge in all its incantations, if you like. Also, honorable members, I think we need to consider the potential, it is certainly not a given, but the potential for North African and sub-Saharan continental drift. And I say that not through reasons perhaps of religion or culture, and not purely from a position of geography. But the fact of the matter is if you look at the trading partners of North Africa, if you look at Morocco, Libya, Algeria, Egypt, for example, if you look at Tunisia, if you look at their trading patterns, their trading partners, the sort of countries that they enter into commercial, financial, and trade agreements, they, of course, orientate around the Mediterranean. They are overwhelmingly northern-looking. If you look at the flight routes from Morocco, we don't have flights to Morocco directly anymore. Morocco essentially orientates itself, and I understand Morocco is an exceptional case, particularly with the AU, but it's not alone. So I would just please urge you to consider what the commercial trade and regional interests are of North Africa as opposed to perhaps West, East, and Southern Africa. They can be quite different, and it draws countries into particular agreements, regional agreements and bilateral agreements. It simply complicates the potential for African unity. We don't look at the world in the same way in many respects as well. This is the kind of, I think this is when ESCOM did have the lights on in Johannesburg and Cape Town. But it does reflect, it's the famous satellite photograph of Europe, Eastern Europe and Africa. And it does point out where we are in terms of the absence of basic infrastructure as a continent. And can I just reiterate that point? Look at North Africa. Look at the tip of Spain. Look at Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, those areas. Look at the Nile towards the east, that stream of light down the Nile. Some light in Accra, Lagos, obviously West Africa, and then a little bit of light, obviously somewhere close to Zimbabwe and Zimbabwe. This photo was taken a few years ago. And then obviously Gauteng in South Africa. Honorable members, that is the reality of electricity reticulation in our continent. And we have the de facto situation that even that picture is under stress, is under threat. The sooner we can get Grand Inga up and running, then so much the better, if that comes to fruition and when that comes to fruition. But that's a very key challenge for us as well. We are left with a situation with, we have the world's least dense road and rail networks. You know this, and this is an issue that I think the Chinese have been quite positive about in terms of assisting our countries, African countries, with the rehabilitation of hard infrastructure roads and rails. We still have the world's lowest tele-densities by a long way. We are the fastest or the most rapid growing continent, of course. In terms of tele-densities, and our cell phone networks are growing rapidly, as we've seen the success of MTN and Vodacom. But nevertheless, our tele-densities and our connectivity is by a long margin the lowest in the world. For those of you and all of you who have flown through Africa, unless you are flying to a conventional route that generally services, if you like, northern countries, in other words, it's a European destination or it's en route to a European destination, it is very, very hard indeed to connect directly to many destinations in Africa. You can connect to capitals, but it is very, very difficult to connect to second cities at the very least. This is changing, and great credit to South African Airways for the work that it's doing. But as you know, to get to Morocco, I make the point, it's an extreme point, but to make the point, that is always a two-flight journey, and sometimes one has to go through Dubai, and then it becomes a sort of an 18-hour journey. By way of contrast, honorable members, to fly from London to Rome is the equivalent of Cape Town to Johannesburg. It's the same flight. So to get from, if you like, Britain to one of the hearts of the EU is exactly the same distance. Just the sheer distance, the magnitude, the lack of transport infrastructure is a great challenge to simply unify Africa in a material way as well. Okay, on to more political questions, more sensitive questions. I think the former questions, the former issues are things that we can work out. It requires investment, it requires infrastructure, etc., etc. But the political questions about the key question that even confronts the European Union today, when a constitution is it an attempt is made not to foist a constitution on member states, but to have a constitution adopted, It seems to be a shock to the commissioners that the constitution was rejected. But it wasn't a shock to many, the populace, the rank and file, the voting population of Europe. And part of this had to do with sovereignty. Part of it had to do with people not really understanding what the constitution was about. Part of it had to do with people in Europe wanting a voice where they felt they didn't have a voice, that Brussels wasn't representing them. And I think that we need to take that very seriously in Africa too. If the EU has had these issues and these challenges, and doesn't have the sort of challenges we have with regard to infrastructure, then we need to take questions of sovereignty very, very seriously in Africa as well. Because for unity to become a reality, by definition, requires yielding some sovereignty to Pan-African bodies. Otherwise, you cannot have unity. You could have 53 institutions articulating together, but if you want anything like a union of African states, questions of sovereignty have to be tackled. And so we have to look very, very seriously, as we are, about the exercise of these Pan-African bodies of executive powers and decision-making powers. And we've gone quite slowly as far as this is concerned. But if our aim is to have a United States of Africa by 2015, that is to say in 7 years' time, this is an extremely challenging It's an extreme challenge for us to even have the debate about levels of sovereignty and subsidiarity as well. How much authority are states willing to yield, and what sort of authority are they willing to yield? Is it authority over defense, over trade policy, over migration questions? Is it over climate change, desertification, migration? Many of these debates have not been had. And I would caution that many of the debates as they have been articulated in the regional economic communities, they themselves have been highly problematical, so much more so at the African Union level. In fact, honorable members, I think you'd agree that to date, very little executive power, if at all, has been ceded to the RECs. And yet we've set ourselves the task of creating a United States of Africa in something like 7 or 8 years' time, when in fact we haven't yet fully worked out the modalities of the relationship between member states and RECs at the political, at the economic, at the trade level, even at the parliamentary level, as we know from the SADC Parliamentary Forum, and that very tense or ongoing debate between transforming the Pan-African Parliament at the SADC PF into a full-fledged parliament. So, are we not, I think in the words of President Mbeki, are we not trying to put the roof on a house without first establishing the foundations? The term variable geometry is one, as you know, that has been used in the EU and other organizations to explain the different pace of accession, the different pace of meeting certain targets in order to reach a state of unity or cohesion or alignment. In other words, certain states simply have greater capacity, greater power, greater ability to reach certain accession targets or certain targets, and others don't. This has been the case in SADC with the free trade agreement, as you know. But if that's been problematical at the regional level, how much more problematical is it when we are trying to unify 53 profoundly diverse states? What criteria are we going to use to set in place a framework of variable geometry? To the bottom bullet point, what are we going to have accession criteria? We have so far had admit one, admit all sort of policy. Not so at the APRM level, I will grant you, but certainly at the AU level. But if there is to be formal unity, political unity, and perhaps a common market, a common currency, and all the other attendant institutions, are we going to roll this process out in terms of the achievement of accession criteria? Well, if that's the case, if that's pragmatic and sensible, what do we do about those states and those countries that simply cannot meet those criteria in the foreseeable future? do we leave them out? Do we advance them? Do we invest in them? Etc., etc. But it is a challenge to unity. Institutionally, honorable members, should we not, it's a challenge to you, should we not first unify and harmonize the RECs before we attempt to harmonize, if you like, a Pan-African framework? Are we getting one step ahead of ourselves? And if we don't, then what role would the RECs play? Will they just become regional trade bodies, etc., etc.? Do they have a purpose then, or are they duplication? Will they merely duplicate the roles that we would expect from the AU or an African government, as it were? Now, the evidence of harmonization with the RECs is very mixed and often quite disappointing in terms of protocols, the achievement of the goals and the aims and the objectives of protocols. We've seen that in SADC to some degree, we've seen it in ECOWAS and indeed COMESA. And we know that there is a sort of spaghetti network of overlapping and overarching and mixed membership of RECs. That has to be disaggregated, it has to be rationalized, and as documentation calls for, audits have to be done. What have they achieved? Where are they? What role would they play within a unified Africa? The more profound challenges that we face on the continent, it is not that we have had conflict, that we have conflict, but we have persistent conflict. We have conflict that lasts decades and runs, in terms of victims in the DRC, into the millions. And as much as we have made significant progress, particularly in the 1990s and the early 2000s, some of the patterns of the emergence or re-emergence of conflict on the continent are extremely worrying. And by definition, where you have civil conflict, this has to be a block to unity, by definition. I mean, that is axiomatic. And the question is, can we possibly achieve African unity without resolving the persistent conflicts that are a feature of every region of our continent? They're not an overarching feature, but whilst they persist, whether it is Cote d'Ivoire, whether it is the DRC, whether it is Somalia, whether it's Ethiopia, Eritrea, whilst those conflicts persist, then can we really achieve meaningful unity in Africa? It is not to say we haven't made considerable progress. We have. We have early warning mechanisms and we have the regional brigades. But, honorable members, these mechanisms are nascent. Yes, they are put in place. They haven't been particularly tested, and we don't know how successful they're going to be. It's an extremely important step or set of steps we've taken, and credit to President Mbeki in this. But at the same time, the concern is the conflicts that we've attempted to tackle, with perhaps the profound acceptance of the DRC, have proved not particularly amenable to resolution, perhaps, is more important. Okay. I didn't want to make too much of this, but I think it has to be stated, honorable members. There are genuine interstate and regional rivalries between states that do not manifest necessarily in cross-border conflict, but there are rivalries. There are different interests, different perspectives. If oil is discovered in Lake Albert in the DRC, in Uganda, the DRC legitimately will make a claim to that oil. Diamonds in Angola, contested because Congolese are mining diamonds there. Angola's interests perhaps challenge and rival some of South Africa's interests. South Africa's commercial interests in the continent, the expansion of South African commercial interests, may in fact set out and be a rival to other indigenous African businesses. Other African companies have different regional interests. And there's not too fine a point that we have leaders in the continent as well that have profoundly different visions and sometimes have large checkbooks and have different motives and have different drivers within the continent. And that debate, I don't think, has always been as public as it may have been or as open, and I don't think we've ventilated that debate. Let me take you back to the Omega plan designed by Abdul Awad, which wasn't a challenger to NEPAD, but it's fascinating to see how when the going gets tough in Zimbabwe, President Awad begins to, if you like, obliquely criticize the initiatives that have been attempted in SADC as being ineffective. We have had similar comments made of our attempts to deal with the Cote d'Ivoire situation. There are these regional leaders or people that see themselves as leaders, and we would have a similar, perhaps a similar perspective from President Gaddafi. These rivalries need to be taken into account. South Africa's reluctant hegemonic status in South Africa, I think, does take these rivalries into account, but they need to be taken into account too. I suppose institutionalism is the wrong word. I suppose it's institution building. It's not institutionalism. Honourable members, we have seen the Pan-African Parliament founded. We have a home for it. We have a building that's being created. And yet we have budgetary problems with the Pan-African Parliament. We have problems of role definition, of agenda setting, etc., etc. Great progress has been made, but I think we are still some way away from conceptualizing what appear to be laudable, progressive, rational, elegant institutions, to building the bricks and mortar, to populating those institutions with like-minded people, or at least people that can put an agenda together and have an agreed-to agenda to determine policy. Ultimately, that's what institutions do. They essentially determine policy. And I would submit to you that whilst we're making considerable progress, it is not enough to build the bricks and mortar. Institutions need character. They need identifiable values around which they orientate, which make them cohere, which fill them out with values, with beliefs, with activity, with programs. It is not simply a case of bricks and mortar. Roles and responsibilities have been identified again at the conceptual level, but in effect, I think we are some way away from seeing exactly how our courts would work in the African Union. The proposal now that we should have a criminal court in Africa, for example, is perhaps an idea whose time has come. But we need to have the debate about what this court would do. If we're going to have a full-fledged Pan-African Parliament, in the second iteration of it, that is an extremely desirable, I would argue, ambitious program that is going to require concerted effort from parliamentarians from all member states. It cannot simply be a visit to the pub for 2 weeks and then back again. This is a program that will require concerted energy, effort, funding, and dedicated people from all countries. Funding remains a challenge. I would ask you the question, who is going to pay for these institutions? At the moment we know, of course, South Africa has been generous in its funding, Nigeria to some degree as well. But do African countries really have the financial capacity to carry, to fund, and to continue funding the institutions that we have designed in our vision for a united Africa? That should not be a barrier to achievement, but it is a significant issue. Look at the backlog in terms of membership fees in so many bodies by African countries. This is not, I don't for one minute think this is because money is being spent on other things that are not desirable, such as clinics and schools. It's an expensive business. For those of you who've been to Brussels, that bureaucracy, 44,000 bureaucrats, Maastricht, all the other areas of the EU and the Commission and the Parliament, etc., and the Council, it's an expensive institution. It has to be funded and not on loans. It has to come from taxpayers. It has to come from the fiscus, and that's exactly where the debate has to take place. Clearly, we have to build capacity in these institutions. And this bullet point, I suppose, should be over every or an overarching question in every slide that I've put together is that of legitimacy. Where do we gain legitimacy for these institutions, for the AU, for an African government, for a council? Where is legitimacy granted? Where is it secured? Where is it renewed? Where does the mandate come from? How is it renewed? And I think one of the challenges for NEPAD has been the fact that perhaps the program was not as popularized as it could have been, and I understand the need to move quickly with NEPAD in a very focused way. I understand that. But perhaps some of the hiccups and the lack of delivery that we've seen with NEPAD, given all the successes, has been around questions of national legitimacy about NEPAD. Who owns it? What does it really mean to us as a country? What does it mean in Nigeria? What does it mean in Mauritius? What does it mean in Egypt? Maybe we should have started at this particular slide. And that is, in essence, I think the African Union is about a different vision of governance. It is about a developmental program, there is no doubt. But whereas I argue that the OAU was almost a backward-looking institution, the AU is a far more forward-looking institution. But to look forward, there has to be a vision. There has to be a roadmap. There has to be a blueprint. There have to be shared values. Now, I would still contend that we do not, amongst the 53 states, have shared ideas or agreement on models of governance preferred. Now, it is not to argue that there has to be one model. Not at all. But the models of governance in Africa, I don't see them being, I think, debated in a healthy manner. And if we are going to have institutions that essentially are there to govern Africa, all 900 million of its citizens, all 53 countries, this can only be achieved if we have some commonality of understanding about questions of good governance, about plural democracy, about how to conduct elections, about monitoring, etc., about accountability, about transparency, about term limitations, about the separation of powers. And this is certainly not an agreed agenda in Africa. Perhaps nominally it may be, and increasingly. In practice, I don't see that in all 53 countries. And I wonder, honorable members, whether or not the APRM is not creating a group of compliant, progressive, virtuous, more virtuous African states or governments, and is differentiating itself, as it should, because people have chosen to undergo APRM and agreeing to be open and to be examined by one's peers and the recalcitrants. Well, then, what do we do with the recalcitrants in the forging of an African Union and a common vision? Now, to date, as far as I know, Botswana has not signed up for the APRM. That doesn't make it a badly run state. It clearly doesn't. It ranks higher than South Africa in terms of TI rankings. But it means that Botswana has issues with the way the APRM is being done, as opposed to the recalcitrants that you may find, for example, in Equatorial Guinea. There is a lot of work to be done, and I would say if there's one pattern in Africa, is an increased differentiation between states, between the more virtuous states and the recalcitrants. And that is a very difficult divide to bridge. I think this is the final slide. Big question. And it leads into this differentiation question. Different states in Africa are differently articulated and engaged with the process of globalization. They may be resource-rich states, but that does take them into particular trading patterns. It does take them into different financial agreements. It does make them more strategic to global interests. It simply does by virtue of their resource base or their position. Globalization has not left Africa alone. It is, in fact, developed, or rather created, inculcated, again, far greater differentiation, not unity. And this is a process that we can't reverse. Perhaps we shouldn't reverse it. The point is, how do we maximize Africa's interests with regard to globalization? We are part of a globalized world that has a differentiated global division of labor. Technologically, production, sourcing, value chains. In other words, what am I saying? Africa's destiny is not entirely in its hands. It's part of a globalized world. It is subject to the interests, the objectives of major states, both the United States or the EU or the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Our destiny is not entirely in our hands. And that is the same for any state in a globalized world. But please, this is something that I think we don't have enough discussion about. There's an assumption that we can determine our own future. Well, yes, but as Marx said, man makes history, but not as he wills. And we are subject to being, by some way, the poorest continent with the least share of global trade, still down at less than 2%, although increasing because of petroleum. We are still subject to the vagaries of the global international financial system and the global trading system and the vagaries of the WTO. And the Doha round is not going particularly well, as much as it's supposed to be a developmental round. So, again, there seems to be pressure on, for example, as Honorable Turok was talking about the other day, pressure to sign EPAs. This has created differentiation, divisions within SADC, within SACU. Because we have different trading and commercial interests to some degree. It's a fact of life that we have to deal with. Again, it goes into the globalized debate and how we deal with that as well. So I think that's about the final slide, honorable members. So probably about 30 or 40 questions with no answers, but that was the lead given by Honorable Sitoli, was to kind of raise issues and have them debated amongst members. Again, to reiterate, very high level of generalization, but I hope some form of stimulation about some of the challenges that we confront before we go merrily along on the assumption that we're going to have a United States of Africa in 2015. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. You've raised quite interesting areas. And you've raised issues of competing interest within the region and within the continent. And you've raised that sometimes these competing interests creates difficulties in how we need to function as a community that seeks to integrate. Of course, if you look at how we approach the economic partnership agreements, that will indicate the fact that at some point, correctly so, our destiny is not entirely dependent on us, and it's not entirely influenced by our own considerations alone. There are other considerations that need to be taken into account, and there are powers that influence how we approach this particular unity. But you have raised a very challenging thought. You are asking the question as to whether it's this unity, the concept of unity, is it real, or is it real? Are we real about advancing this particular concept? Are we advancing this concept influenced by realities? As you go with your presentation, you start questioning those realities as to whether this concept of unity with all these competing areas of work and sometimes very conflicting interests of each state, are they not militating against this particular unity? And I think that it's sometimes demonstrated by the fact that when we deal with other states outside the continent, we seek to undo other member states and present ourselves as more better than the next. Hence, we come back and argue for unity, but when we do our work, we actually do the work in a manner that compromises the interest of the whole to the benefit of the individual. And I think those states that have influence over us, they've seen that weakness, and they play into that weakness. Rob Tom, give it to John, and take a little bit of John, give it to somebody else, and get everybody squabbling and trying to outshine the other. But the issue that I thought will also go deeper in, and maybe members will have to deal with that. You know, South Africa has been in the monetary union for some time with certain countries. But if you look at that monetary union, I do not see that we have used it to learn from it and to move that process into possibly a closer cooperation. I think we tended to leave that monetary union as a loose arrangement, and I don't see it. I don't see us learning from it to say how best can we move the process of integration further than just the monetary union, and that will then have informed our experiences in SACU as to how then you move SACU forward and build on that experience in building up into a regional free trade arrangement and be able to integrate the region. There will be political differences from one country to another, but there must be an overarching common values that are pursued by that particular community. I don't see us learning from that. In this paper, you raise the fact that you raise the fact that the unity cannot be proclaimed. And it should be something that comes from an engagement between the citizenry and the political leadership. Now, if we are to look at the debate, the union government debate, a number of countries went to that summit, won that summit to take a decision and move forward, which is what you say that it cannot be proclaimed. And if there was no resistance, we would have done the proclamation. And therefore, the issues of legitimacy that you are raising comes to the fore, that having proclaimed, what then happens? And I'm saying that is quite an interesting concept as to how then do you engage citizenry. And I'm raising also this in the light that when NIPAT was put in place, there were a plethora of views, and in fact at some point NIPAT was said to have been imposed. And now how do you go about engaging the whole of society into those issues? But I'm raising those issues also as additional questions so that when people contribute, they can reflect on them. Honorable members, I'm going to invite you to make your thoughts. As I said, that we are not going to ask Tim to answer questions, but we expect members to express their own views as to whether what Tim says, that we have not really engaged with this concept of unity, and we might be just be scratching the surface. Maybe the question is, how genuine are we in this unity? How genuine are we in this unity? Are we really pursuing the unity for the sake of being politically correct, or are we pursuing the unity because we believe that we need this unity? And if we do need it, why? What are the imperatives that makes us to need this particular unity? And are we committed to are those imperatives also affecting all other 53 member states, or are they only affecting one member state? What are the interests of individual leaders in this particular area? The last issue is the question of anchor states. You know, when you look at the case study of the EU, you realize that there were anchor states that were prepared to underwrite the project. Who in the continent is prepared to underwrite this project of unity? If we have not been able, and I'm raising this to South Africans, if we have not been able to underwrite that project on the monetary union, you've got three or four countries in the monetary union, and underdeveloped, we are the strongest entity in that. We have not been able to underwrite just that small entity to move it together, to streamline our political system, to streamline our economic system, to streamline our laws, when our population are actually one. Geography gives us an advantage, language gives us an advantage, culture gives us an advantage, but we have not been able to move into a situation where we consolidate just that small community If you go to Swaziland, a Swazi-speaking person in Swaziland and a Swazi-speaking person across the border, the culture is the same, the language is the same, everything is the same. But we've not been able to capitalize on that. So the question is, what can we learn from that? And how, who's going to underwrite this project? Which investor is willing to put his money into that project? Because if we don't have that investor, then we are not going to be able to get that project going. Honorable members, Honorable Mayor, Honorable Srema.
Thank you, Chair. Tim, our brief was originally for somebody to look at the impediments, which you have done brilliantly in some ways, most ways, that militate against African unity. I'd like to suggest to you, and to this media actually, that those are facts known to us. It's pretty open and clear. But I just want to go back in view of the fact that we're not going to ask you questions and we're going to express views. I think your context, while your presentation is on the mark, but I'm surprised that Sahel does not look at the global picture of Africa in relationship to the realities in Africa. That we have this tendency of comparing dissimilar situations. I'll give you two examples. The Union of South Africa was preceded by war. People went to war, Brits and Boers. And what united it was a common native policy. And that was the genesis of the Union of South Africa. Just one country, which is not a union then. The EU is precursed by war. The interests of one Christian kingdom, so to speak, geographical kingdom, one racial group, diverse languages, common heritage, they had to go to war for whatever reason. And perhaps the wisdom prevailed and said, look, this must stop. However, having said that, I'm just saying that we in Africa are seized not only with the question of infrastructure deficiencies or money or the question of sovereignty. I don't know what was before Africa was scrambled for. I don't know what Africa was. You get my drift. What was Africa before 1856 or whatever the date was? Now, what I'm saying, in having motivated the topic for discussion today so that we as parliamentarians become proactive in taking the considerations forward, no matter how painful it is for us to be confronted with this vulgarity called xenophobic tendencies in our own country. But I want to suggest to you, Tim, and to my colleagues in Parliament, there's a view held by some that China currently feeds, in some ways, on the resources of Africa. It's not my view. But I agree with that. Now, to what extent would the Chinese presence in Africa militate against the ascendancy of a kind of union that you and I seek, as well as South Africans, on the one hand? What is Gaddafi's interest in seeking to do what he seeks to do in Africa? Here's what Comrade Chair said, who is going to fund this? I'm saying, rather bravely, just say yes to Gaddafi and fund the entire exercise. So what is his motivation? Is there a concept of religious ascendancy or a religious hegemony over the whole of Africa? Can Gaddafi, on the one hand, say what has he done in terms of disease control management in Africa? Or water conservation and soil conservation in addition to it in Africa? In relationship to what he spends on proselytization and conversion? Or any religious race for that matter? But what is the tendency? And I think it is rather incomplete in our evaluation of the impediments that militate against African unity to disregard these factors, which must lead us to the point, Tim, where the weaknesses of Africa transform themselves into the strengths of other countries with diverse interests, given the history of Africa. Now, you mentioned in passing, and I realize you're doing this, if you may allow me to say this, with tongue in your cheek. You just passed over Omega. We have a particular position in Parliament on NAPAD and Omega. We were very coarse sometimes, but very open. And no matter how much Ben Turok's euphoria about Africa at the last parliamentary input that he made is ballooned and pricked. I feel sorry for him through by you. but we cannot exclude these factors as impediments. The question of tribalism you have not as a subjective weakness on the African continent. Sorry. I think most of us here who are around my age cannot deny that Busia in Ghana was the first victim of the father of Pan-Africanism. We cannot deny that Oginga Odinga was a major victim of Kenyatta in Kenya. As internal subjective witnesses, whether it is for dictatorship tendencies or power relationships, or the emergence ascendancy of tribalism. While it is a subjective factor, to what extent have tribalism been used in most parts of the world to manipulate, and by whom, which again together militate against African unity? My last point, and I want to make this very, very clear, and I want to read this entire discussion in this, Mr. Chairperson, in relationship to our own country. The sadness that we have, this vulgarity that we are confronted with, I didn't ever realize that it would happen in my lifetime. But what I do know, Tim, is what happened in my lifetime prior to this. We are sitting in an area called the Western Cape. Xenophobia of another kind, but xenophobia indeed, with the Western Cape, Western removals. And when the Ciskei becomes a dumping ground for what kind of xenophobic tendency? Amongst us, we have a very learned lawyer. What will be our impressions of the introduction of the Group Areas Act, which was given legal respectability? In fact, in my days of liberation politics, I used to call it legalized theft. Now, the Group Areas Act, is it xenophobic or not? I think it is. We separate people in the way South Africa did. With respect, and I do not want to hurt anybody's sensibilities, the clamor for a different state within a state in our own country today, based on what? Okay, we'll take for granted that South Africa has problems in respect of unemployment, resources, etc., etc., etc. We'll grant all that. But whilst I admit this vulgarity exists in our country, we cannot exclude these realities. And the reality currently, where negotiations are sought where opinions are given, where a state, so-called state within a state, is desired by a particular tendency in our country. Now, what I'm saying, Tim, we are aspiring towards uniting Africa. And on our doorstep, in our own country, I'm not going to go into many more details about Inanda, ethnic cleansing, and all that stuff, right? But what I want to say is the ghettoing of our people is no different from the expulsion of people. Forced expulsion by criminals, call them criminals if you wish to, by xenophobians, call them that if you wish to. But in the context of South African history, I'm not surprised that this is happening. Because what comes around, goes around, must come around. In a different way, albeit. So, Che, I'm glad that we're having this discussion, because we were seized with the responsibility of not just listening to and asking questions. So how parliamentarians can become integral to policy positions and articulation of views that must impact. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Mayor. Honourable Sramani.
Thanks, Chairperson. And as usual, I must commend the presenter for the brilliant point he raised. But I had written a short list for myself. It's a repetition of what my colleague has already said. It serves merely as to emphasize what he has repeated, but it's very short. I would have also wanted to have a subtitle to this, or something that follows as after a preface, that in addition to the title we have here, we should really say, what are the points for robust and honest introspection by African states individually and collectively, where we don't spare each other, nor ourselves, but truly introspect to find out what the problem is, that or the problems are that work against or militate against African unity. And we haven't said much, and I think it's an area that we need to explore very deeply, the question of tribalism or ethnicity, hooked to it, xenophobia, that seems to be worrying us and bothering us a lot these days. Also the question of religion, fundamentalism, and what I call hyper-evangelism, because these are the main issues that seem to be working against African unity and in terms of humanity itself. The conflicts always stem from that point. What is it that we should be doing? And also, in our African experience, how does the use of child soldiers ultimately sustain the false notions of tribalism, ethnicity, and all the type of thing, of conflict? You raise a child soldier, becomes a soldier, becomes an adult, sees things the way he or she has been taught by the experience. Will we ever come to a point where we say African unity, our African unity is intact when we continue using child soldiers for our various conflicts? And perhaps the last one would also be our cultural practices. All of us, all and sundry, have to look at our cultural practice. How do we contradict the vision of African unity? And even in our institutions, such as Parliament, how divisive are we, or helpful are we, in actually injuring the attempt of an African society that is united? Do we capitalize on who we are, where we come from, what languages we speak, what ideological groups we belong to, or are we mature enough, or have we found ways of handling this thing so that they must not militate against unity? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Can I join Honourable Miwa in congratulating you on a brilliant exposition of the problems facing Pan-African or Pan-Africanism in Africa? But I just wanted to suggest to you that an African Union government and a Pan-African Parliament are a little bit like motherhood and apple pie when it comes to Africa. I mean, there's certainly no harm in supporting it. It's a nice idea. So the question is it really necessary to engage with any fierceness or purpose? Because it would appear that there's absolutely no downside to the idea. I mean, we can all support it with a clear conscience. It's a wonderful goal to have. Yeah, the idea has always appeared to be incremental, surrounded by incrementalism. And there doesn't seem to be any pressure, really, in actually achieving even the 15-year summary of goals, or shall I say from two, it's not, it's tonight, what's my arithmetic, 9-year summary. Yeah. In fact, if you look at what's set out to be achieved in the first 3 years, I don't think we're any remotely near achieving them, and the others look pretty difficult to achieve if you look at the subsequent 2-3-year periods. So my point really is there doesn't seem to be any downside to supporting the idea, but there seems to be no pressure to actually achieving it either on the part of the nation. So do the problems really matter? I mean, we can sort of slowly, we can all with a clear conscience support the idea and feel good about it. And maybe something will happen. It's like maybe the emperor's horse will learn to speak, you know, if we just carry on that way. And that's my first point. I'd like your comment. And does it matter, really, all these problems? But surely there can be no downside. The second point is that where you have the EU or other groups of countries or continental unifications and so on, like you have there's always a bottom line. I mean, there's a bottom line for all the countries, and that's what persuaded, for instance, the UK to come on board. There was a security bottom line and a material bottom line, which was, it's always the overriding factor among human beings. And it doesn't appear to be the case, you didn't particularly address that. Is there potentially a bottom line for the African countries which will be overwhelmingly persuasive in the end to get them together, in your view?
I think, Tim, you should link that with your initial comment when you said that the OAU was a negative unity, given the fact that it was anti-something, whilst the AU unit is quite different from the OAU. Will that not have been an underwriting or an underlying element of being anti-colonialism, and therefore the unit in that instance was driven by the challenges of liberation, as opposed to an underlying factor in the current what you call as positive unity? Thank you.
Yes, thanks very much. I thought they were all very interesting. But I have a few critical comments. I think, firstly, that your vision of African unity is a bit idealistic and ideal type in character. If you look at what's going on in Europe and you think that's an ideal version of European unity, well, ask the Europeans and they will tell you that the deployment of power throughout the numerous institutions of Europe is very perplexing. There are national parliaments, there's a European parliament, there's a commission, and so on. And indeed, African unity will not come in accordance with some sort of idealized version of institutional cooperation and coordination. It will come untidily, as it is coming, as Europe has come. The only hope we have is that it's expedited. But it will not be a tidy process where somebody or some group of people sit down and say, international relations theory requires us to have A, B, C, and D,
it won't come like that, because there are powers, there are forces, there are interests. It's an untidy business, as Europe has shown. We only hope that Africa can move faster. Then the question of regional integration. Now, when the Pan-African Parliament was due to be established, this Parliament established a committee under the leadership of Greenwich and Waller. We discussed the question of regional integration. And we were clear there that conventional regional integration through customs unions, through tariff issues, is not suitable for Africa. We require a far more focus on socio-economic integration. Because, in fact, cross-border trade in some of our regions is bigger than formal trade. People are integrated. They cross borders, they sell this and buy that informally. So, you know, to talk about the regional integration again in orthodox conventional terms of regional integration through customs unions and so on is again idealistic, because Africa is actually, there's a fair degree of integration already on the ground between, as Mewa was saying, like-minded people, similar language, similar history, etc. There is that integration. And sometimes it seems the state gets in the way. State institutions which impose tariffs and duties and border controls get in the way of African integration and regional integration. So let's not be too kind of formalistic about how this thing happens. The next point is the question of being anti. Yes, you're quite right. The OAU was founded as an anti-imperialist, anti-colonial movement. But I must tell you that there is a degree of like-minded. I was asked to make a presentation at the Pan-African Parliament, as somebody was saying, on the Economic Partnership Agreement. And I must tell you that I took a view that Europe is actually exercising enormous pressure on Africa to adopt these EPAs, which are, in general, disadvantageous to Africa and therefore asymmetrical, and I found almost total agreement at the conference, at the meeting. MP after MP got up in the PAP and agreed that Africa must exercise, to quote this document, much more self-reliance and much more self-sufficiency, and that should be our model, rather than dependency on Europe, which hasn't certainly brought a great deal to Africa, although of course we can't disengage. So, you know, I think there is a foundation for not an anti, but a common interest unity based on the fact that we live in a fairly hostile world where the powerful are looking after themselves. And Africa has to look a little bit inwardly and say, let's practice what the main document from the AU says, self-reliance, collective self-reliance, and self-sufficiency. The infrastructure point, I think your point about, you know, telephone going through Paris if you want to communicate and airlines going through to Europe rather than across Africa, I think one should take account of the internet. Something quite miraculous is happening. I myself use the internet right across Africa. I'm not saying this. It's enormously interactive, but it's there. And quite a lot of people are using the internet when the roads and railways and airlines are actually focused on Europe rather than within Africa. So something new is happening there. Then my final point is something that disturbs me a great deal, and maybe Saya might want to look into it, and that is the question of intellectuals. You know, in most countries, in most continents, where there's, take Latin America, where there's a vision of a continental unity, and Europe the same, the intellectuals played a major role in providing a vision for a new continent, a new future. In Africa, regrettably, for reasons we can discuss at length, the intellectuals are absent. Our universities are not promoting Pan-Africanism. Our universities are full of cynics, very cynical of African governments, cynical of the AU. They were terribly cynical about NEPAD, and maybe continue to be so. The same is true in South Africa, that our universities do not teach and create visions of a Pan-Africanism based on Nkrumah's vision and so on. Instead, there's enormous cynicism
about Africa. In fact, in this parliament, I found a great deal of cynicism the other day in the debate we had here. So, you know, that is a problem. Why is it that the intellectuals of Africa, who should be progressive, who should be leading the way, who should be writing, and maybe Saya as well, should be writing and promoting the notion of the advantages of continental unity, are not doing that. Instead, enormous cynicism, enormous disengagement, dislike, distrust of their own leaders. And I think that's an important issue, Chair, that maybe this committee could explore. Why is it that Africa's intellectuals are not with us in pushing for a united Africa? They disengaged, alienated. It needs examination. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Turok raises the fact that intellectuals are disengaging. I think, Tim, you need to come to that, because it has been an issue for some time, and I remember that the President at some point raised it to say that our intellectuals aren't coming forward to engage with these issues, to deal with these issues, so that they can provide more clarity of thoughts that goes into it. But also, Honorable Ben raises the fact that the unity of the continent will come organically. But I thought that when you advance this organic development of the unity, you will then deal with the competing interests member states. You will then deal with the competing interests that your commercial community will feel when you continue to propagate the non-regulatory element of cross-border trade. To what extent does that erode your economic fundamentals? Is it not important that, in fact, you should be putting up measures? Not measures to stop it, but measures that will then ensure that whatever comes in and whatever goes out, it's understood and is of a quality that is needed. So I'm saying, as much as there's this informal trade, I thought that you'll then take it further and argue that, in fact, to some extent, that will have its own impact on how the economics are run in the continent. And I thought that this organic development will also be able to answer on our political systems in the continent, because I think the other problems that militate against our unity is how our political systems function and work. Will you say that South Africa is better governed in relation to Swaziland, in relation to Zimbabwe? How then do you unite the region, if you have all those political differences, where you have elections and you have a monarchy, and you have a Lesotho with a different arrangement also? You're sitting with those all combination of factors that on one hand, society and people have moved, but your institutional, the institutions of governance have not actually moved. In terms of integrating, I think Honorable Sibosa, when they went to the borders, the police said to them, "You want us to police the borders? Let's show you how the situation is." And they took them to a corner and they said, "Look at those kids. They're playing soccer. They come from the neighboring country. They played soccer there. Those ones are going to the shop on the other side and they're going back home. What do you want us to do? Ask these kids passports? We're not going to do that." So I agree with the fact that, yes, people have integrated, but our political institutions have not moved, and I think they are an obstacle in the process. Now, the question is, how then do you move those institutions to be able to deliver that unity? To what extent have we learned from the institutions that we have to move forward our integration? Sitting where I'm sitting, I think that our governments are actually an obstacle, and in fact, I do not believe that at some point all 54 member states, we mean the same thing when we talk about the unity of the continent.
women different things at different times, and we want to achieve different objectives. And the other question that probably I will throw to the floor is, to what extent this unity threatens the existence of our states as they exist now? To what extent, when you unite the people, expose the people to democratic processes, threaten the existence of those states as they exist today? And therefore, them being regarded, that unity being regarded as a negative influence to what could have been regarded as a stable process. I'll come to you, back to you, Honorable Hajjaj.
Yes, can I bring something to your attention? The program for the girl children at work is that we're meant to be at a lunch at 12:30. And I just apologize. I'm going to have to leave in a few minutes. So I hope you forgive me for not waiting for the answer to my question from the speaker, unless you'd permit it before I go.
Now you are released.
Thank you.
Yeah. Honorable Hajjaj, and I'll come back to you.
I've had the same problem, sir, before we go.
To
I have something to say, but I'm not sure.
Oh.
I thought you were a grown-up.
I'm a grown-up, yes, but I'm 30 girls for somebody. Okay, let's start with you. We'll come back. Yeah.
Sorry, sir, but I've got an appointment and there's no way. They've already SMS'd me and said he's waiting for me. Now, I think it's a fascinating subject, and sorry the time is limited. I think, number one, Africa, and we are all not going to escape the realities of the world trends at the moment. And the world trends, as far as I'm concerned, is that national states are more and more artificial and less major players in the national scene. That's old politics, national states. The trends, as far as I can see it, and look at Europe, look at the East, look at the Americas, is regional cooperation with the first phase economic regional cooperation without any doubt. And then also, and I know that's what Mia is very nervous about, stronger national identities within the regional. If you look at, there's a very interesting book, I suppose Tim has read it, from Naisbitt, John Naisbitt, the title is Global Paradox. And he writes exactly on this, saying, how does it make sense? The world's becoming bigger and bigger unity, and at the same time there's more national groups or countries, whatever you call it, within Europe. And it, say again?
Identities.
And it seems that once you get this balance right between national and local, global and local, that's more or less a recipe in a sense that can work in the long run. And that's the future, and Africa is behind at the moment, but we're catching up. So the one question brought in, I will not be here to answer. My criticism at the new AU, when it started, was I strongly support it. Surely we need it because we're staying behind. Europe is leaving us back, the East is leaving us. But the Pan-African idealism of creating it at once is the big problem that's going to fail in the first instance. And we must learn from other regions, surely moving slowly, and maybe first getting members in that is acceptable or is part of it. I had a discussion with ANC leaders that was very critical of what they called the old men of Africa, you know, the Gaddafis and the Mugabes in a sense, and say that new young leaders, they will put Africa on the map. And I thought, well, maybe let's start with the young ones and see whether we can't get something going as Europe did, you know, with 1, 2, 3 leaders and countries and then another one, another one. Turkey is now struggling at the moment, and that was successful. But I think it was too much idealism to think you're going to put 53 together and immediately it will work. I'm afraid we'll have to go back again and reinvent the whole thing from that stage. But the global trend is here, whether we like it or not, and that's reality in the end. And those kids playing around there is part of the future. But you're also not going to ignore identities as such. Look at the Scots, look at the Flemish, look at those. But you must manage them. If you don't manage it, then you're creating problems. And it's easy to manage them because they get the privileges and the advantages of this big economic. And they can't afford to go on their own. The boss can't afford to go on their own. They need the economic biggest picture. But they need some more control over their own culture and identity. And I think that's the balance in the end. So sorry for running, but really he's waiting. And I've got the SMS in my office already. Thank you for that.
Honourable members, we are not going to conclude. This is setting up of a debate, so don't think that we are going to have a resolution at the end, because it's a debate that we need to take forward at some point. I'll come back to you, Honourable Streman. Honourable Hatta, she gave her right to to Honorable Mulder. So we need to go back to her.
Comic Chair, I just want to make a few points. First of all, I think that Tim was correct in the analysis of the whole thing. And as Mewa said, it is actually facts that we are all aware of, and we have debated this at different times and at different podia. Now, I think when we talk about the African Union and the time frames that were given and the Abuja Constitutive Act that created all these organs that brought that would be brought into place. I think, of course, I think it was rather presumptuous in terms of time, because there's no way, if we, as Tim said, and we all know, if it took Europe 60 years to get where it is, and where it hasn't managed to resolve all the problems that Europe is sitting with, then I think that we should not be despondent. This is the first step. A baby is born, and the first this idea of an African Union government is just the birth of this baby. It's going to be a year, 2 years, until it's an adult. And with it, it will come a whole lot of issues will be resolved in the process, I hope, with the determination of African leaders. Talking about the RECs, they are supposed to be the building blocks. We are having enormous problems with the RECs. I mean, let's not play games here. This is what is happening in our own region, Southern African region. We've seen it in ECOWAS, where they've done some good work, the Maghreb Union, which is dormant. SADC PF is trying very hard to become a parliament. Some of us feel it's ready, some of us feel it's not ready. The only one that has some legislative power is the East African community. And of course, you have the Central African, what you call it, enormous problems in all of these. And it is correct that we are, Africa is composed of Africans who have come from different tribes and different cultural backgrounds, from the north to the south. And I think here you have Europe, which is much smaller than Africa as a continent. And if you look at all the little groupings in Europe, and you find Switzerland, part of Switzerland is French-speaking, and the other bit is German-speaking, and the other bit is God knows what. But and this goes on, and you can go to the Balkans, and you see the problems that are there, and all the rest of it. So this whole concept of unification and uniting a continent is not an easy matter, and I think all of us understand that, or ought to understand that. So for me, one of the big problems, I think, is as we go along trying to harmonize, because that's where it comes, even in our own region, in SADC, harmonize our trade laws, our judicial laws, our all manner of things, you know, even in terms of our Bill of Rights. I mean, there's no question that not every state is not going to have to just cede a little bit of sovereignty. It's going to have to cede a lot of sovereignty. And the point is, the first thing we're going to have to do is, in all states, is to make African leaders understand what that means, what that ceding of sovereignty means, before we can build a some kind of unity. I just want to touch on just two, we don't have much time, on the whole process of NEPAD. Now, for me, I still do believe that we need to make NEPAD work. When we talk about having to go through France to get to Morocco, or to go from here to get to Senegal through France, or whatever the case is. In the Pan-African Parliament, there are a whole lot of... The Pan-African Parliament, first of all, is a very new parliament. It's only sitting for 4 years. It has enormous teething problems in terms of administration and all the rest of it. But I need to tell you this, that the first 2 years of that parliament, one was actually shocked and disappointed because the parliamentarians who came there were either afraid to talk because they've never had a chance to talk freely in their own parliament. Then we saw, you know, the topics that were brought for discussion also were of a higher quality. It wasn't just the usual thing, the conflicts in Africa and what are we going to do. There were substantive discussions on a whole lot of issues about democracy and accountability and all that, which Pan-African other parliamentarians, unlike us, didn't have a chance to discuss it in that. So the Pan-African Parliament provided a forum for those parliamentarians to come out and speak how they are feeling. That was important. The committees all were then divided, there were 10 of them, with the prime object to look at NEPAD. I know that the Transport and Communications Committee and other committees, Human Rights and Justice and Trade and Migration, those were coupled together, have started the process of looking at what Africa needs and how can we do it, what monies do we have. And I have been asking our parliament to produce that document, and I'm asking again for all our parliamentarians to look at what plans are there for roads, for dams, for electrification, what monies are there available for those, what money is outstanding, that's still needed, and what are the possible ways of getting that. Because as you know, NEPAD was supposed to be a partnership. That, we will not go into it at this point. So for me, that is a cornerstone. If we can learn to start to build, you know, the programs and actually... let them evolve into projects, substantial, real projects, then we are getting somewhere. Then also people will begin to understand what is this thing NEPAD about. You go anywhere, never mind into the townships, you go, you speak to other parliamentarians from Africa, and you're talking about NEPAD, and they'll come to you and say, sister, but what is this thing called NEPAD? What is this thing NEPAD that you're talking about? So there is not enough, and this is our fault, it's in our country too. I'm not just talking about elsewhere. In our own country. And it's partly our fault. We have not managed to actually discuss these things that we are trying to build and bring about with our people. And the same thing goes for the Pan-African Parliament, and we tell them all the time. You have to go back to the constituencies. You have to go back and talk to your people. You have to bring this talk about these things in your parliament about this whole thing. So this is one of the problems. One of the problems of PEP also is that it was for 5 years, according to the Constitutive Act. After 5 years, that is the end of next year, the African Union will have to decide whether it can be a legislative body or not, whether it can make laws for Africa. Now, as far as I'm concerned, and I think it is in the last debate, last 2 weeks or 2 weeks ago, the majority of the parliamentarians quite rightly decided that we are not ready to have a Pan-African Parliament for Africa that has legislative powers. Now, that is mature, realistic thinking. And that also comes back to the baby that is was born and is taking its first steps. And it's going to take a whole lot of steps and grow to quite a, what you're before all of this is going to be put together. The one thing that worries me, and this is something that quite a few people touched on, was the fact that Africa has enormous resources, and it goes back to that, has enormous resources, which in the main is not controlled by Africa and its people. And this IPA thing that we see, the equality, equal partnership agreements, as far as I'm concerned, and I stand to be corrected, is colonization through the back door. And I say it very openly here. Because when you start analyzing all of these things, you know, and the Cotonou agreements and the Uruguay and whatever, whatever, there were certain things given to Africa, you know, tariffs will be lowered and you have preferential treatment, whatever, whatever. Now, the thing is, we are equal. Europe is equal now to Africa. How can we be equal? We are unequal in everything, in our political systems, our democratic systems, our economic systems. We are how can we be equal partners when we are unequal? So who are they fooling? They still give subsidies to their farmers. There's no way that Africa can compete even in the basic agricultural sector, never mind the manufacturing sector. Worst products that come from Europe. So Europe will be dumping everything, whatever they want to, in Africa. What are we? Do we have we built the capacity? Can we build the capacity? Will we be given a chance to build capacity to be able to progress to a stage where we can become equal partners? So I think we still have a long way to go. And I think I'm just going to stop there. It's almost 1 o'clock. Thank you.
I just wanted to piggyback on what Professor Turok mentioned about intellectualism. I think also the converse side that needs to be looked at is the contempt that grassroots activists have for intellectualism. We can call them young lions or wimping pussy cats, whatever we want to call them, but they have a strong contempt for intellectualism. How do we hold that tension? Thank you.
Chair,
I just want to go back to Tim's point on sovereignty. The nation-state system indeed is a European concept which emanated over the centuries. It would be presumptuous on anybody's part to believe that in a union of the kind we visualize for Africa, that the question of sovereignty will not come into play. Sovereignty rooted in whatever, whether it's as a surrogate state of somebody else or based on tribalism or whatever the case might be. But we cannot discount the reality that for any union to take place for self-preservation, leave the idealism out of this, for self-preservation, there must be a renunciation of some parts or aspects of sovereignty. There's no doubt of the fact. Now, unless we're looking for a world governance with a single legal system, with a single constitution, etc., etc., the European Union doesn't have it at this stage. While they have renounced some aspects of their sovereignties, but they continue to exist as nation states to the extent that the compulsions of economic ascendancy and superiority for them to have is a combination of their forces put together on the one hand. On the other hand, your sovereignty takes a second place when the European Union is being considered on a different phase, on the question of race. Who are members of the European Union? Hitherto enemies? Former enemies, on the one hand. What is the compulsion for the European Union to extend its hand for inclusion to the Eastern European countries? What is the dynamic? what are the compulsions? Now, what I'm saying, Tim, I'm not an academic, nor am I a scientist. I'm just an activist. My activism tells me this, that a question of survival in a competitive world, cruel world, unfeeling world, unbridled economically world, will lead people to get together, will force people to get together to survive. Example, what were the compulsions of De Gaulle in the post-World War period? To have spearheaded the concept of the European Union. Was it the competition of the dollar, the hegemony of the United States of America? What was it? But let us assume that there's a combination of those forces at the back of their heads to say, never again. Never again are we going to fight a war on our land. I mean, we haven't had a war since 1945 in Europe. On the other hand, Tim, in your equations there, I mean, I'm quite impressed with what you have done. Africa in that same period, between post-1945 and now, was a theater of war, a theater of conflict all along. What is the qualitative nature of the impediments? Fatima puts it, colonialism, imperialism to the back door. To what extent the interests of that very European Union, whose, in broad terms, whose economic survival, in broad terms, was based on the resources of Africa, would they want Africa to be competitive with them? For us to comprehend the amount of money given to cattle, and I repeat, to cattle, is more than the amount earned by African people in Africa. And that is their subsidy, just of cattle. Let alone the fact that they are paid not to farm. Leave alone getting subsidies. They are paid not to farm. And today we have a crisis internationally, which must impede against the unification of any region like Africa, with the lack of capacity, all the negative aspects. Let's assume, let's be charitable to the others and say, you know what, we're self-critical. We have all the problems. Let's find out where do you come in as a problem. And I think the overwhelming problems in Africa are the problems of exploitation. Are the problems of exploiting resources in Africa, is a problem of production. I mean, you take the Chinese, for instance. Taiwan is in one stage, and the Chinese now. How many of us are aware that Taiwan was present in Africa, in South Africa, under the apartheid regime, building up border industries, given subsidies, tax-free, for 7 years, 12% railway surcharges for 12 years, repatriation of earnings ad lib. We are there today. So the self-interest of other countries must determine the patterns of our own inefficiency and our own capacity. Now, another example, Mr. Chairperson, is the Chinese who are coming in, and as far as I'm concerned as a rank-and-file activists, that are chasing oil in Sudan, that are chasing oil in Angola, wherever. Let's say this is good, okay, for them and for Africa. But let's find out what was not good for Africa. They built the Trans-Am Railway. How many technicians, how many engineers of African origin were trained? And the Trans-Am Railway took years to complete. How many engineers have they left? What were they doing? So, I'm not only talking of the imperialist world, I'm talking currently the Chinese world. What is their agenda? Now, who are their allies? Is it true that Mugabe will be and is in some ways financed by China. Is it true that Libya finances Zimbabwe? What are their agendas? So, Tim, we motivated very strongly that you do this presentation today. Whilst we are looking at the objective factors impeding African unity, we will desist from believing that we do not have subjective weaknesses ourselves. We do. But when the subjective weaknesses are compounded by alien factors outside of ourselves, outside of our control, then it becomes, then your presentation through Sai has got to be redefined, if I may say so respectfully.
Jim, I'm coming to you, but what Honorable Mayor did not do at the end is that it is said that the Chinese could be assisting Mugabe, they could be said that Libya could be assisting Mugabe, but it did not tell us what the role of the European Union in assisting or not assisting Mugabe, the role of the U.S. in assisting and not assisting Mugabe. In fact, it didn't tell us what was their role in plunging Zimbabwe to a level where it is today. Because Zimbabwe's meltdown was not just an event, it was an orchestrated decision made to deal with particular situations. And therefore, what he has not come to tell us is, did we wake up and find Zimbabwe as it is? Or somebody who had a different interest, and in fact, in some instances, motivated by racism, decided that Zimbabwe has to go, and therefore personified the problem in Zimbabwe into an individual. And all of us today are singing the song that I always say, I don't know, Comrade Mayor, where it was composed. And we all sing it with pride, with vigor, with enthusiasm, but we do not know the composer. We do not know the composer. And what were the objectives of the composer in composing that song? I accept, I sit here as the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, I get asked what South Africa is doing in Zimbabwe every time. But I'm saying that I've always desisted from singing a song that I don't know. Because I've learned over time that we did not wake up in the morning and Zimbabwe was in a meltdown. It starts very far. And if you go through the economy structure, you know, for something fascinating, Tim, all of intellectuals, as Honorable Suleimani says, that they are being viewed with contempt in the township. It's because intellectuals always tell us that the problem in Zimbabwe is nothing else but a human rights issue. But it's not the fact. It's not the fact. They tell us that Zimbabwe 12 years or 20 years ago was the basket in Africa. But what they don't tell us is that that basket was produced by a handful. Was produced by a handful, and the masses of the people of Zimbabwe were reduced to consumers. That in fact the economy of Zimbabwe, over 60% of it was run by few firms in Zimbabwe. And that's a basket that people tell us that, no, it was a basket bread of Africa, but they don't tell us in fact what was inside the basket, the bread basket. So I'm saying to him, so these are some of the debates that at some point we need to engage in. But I want to give you the time to reflect on the debate. But in doing so, I want you to also look at the issues of the Economic Partnership Agreements. We call them any other form. They're just basically, I said it when we met the EU delegation, that is a recolonization. And in fact, all the member states who have colonized the continent, they are doing it again on behalf of the new member state to recolonize the continent. But what was it that you believe we, subjectively so, who have actually delivered our souls
on the platter ourselves. Because if you look at, I'm going to just deal with the Sadek Ipa. The Sadek Ipa, people were prepared to sacrifice Zaku for the Sadek Ipa. Were this motivated by any other reason? Because I cannot believe that if you have to sacrifice an institution that has been feeding you for something that is not there, what the bulk of the budget in Lesotho comes from SACCO. The bulk of the budget in Swaziland comes from SACCO. But these are the countries that were prepared to sacrifice SACCO and sign IPAs. I'm like Mayor, I'm not a politician, I'm an activist, and in fact, Parliament gives me the opportunity to can raise issues that I may not be able to raise in other circumstances. Why has South Africa not walked away from SACCO? Why we did not walk away from it? Why were we compelled to stay in when our economy has been gambled with? Because the new generation issues, when the EU signed the new generation issues, and particularly issue on services, what services are you really talking about in Lesotho and Swaziland? Botswana, yes, there are some. But in Lesotho and Swaziland, what really are you talking about? Was it not a backdoor entry to the South African market? And why did we stay on when our economy has been gambled with? Now, you come to South Africans today, we are said to be xenophobic. I've always maintained the fact that, in fact, I raised that with you at some point, that we are not xenophobic. I think it's our inability to deal with our own integration as a South African, and also with the fact that we have people that are coming outside, and we are just struggling to find ourselves. Now, if we are sitting with an economy like South Africa, with an unemployment that we are sitting with, and a powerful institution like the EU compromises your economy, and your neighbor next door is prepared to build a tunnel to that, what do? You shut the door so that the EU must pick up the pieces. But we didn't. And I'm puzzled why we didn't do that. Is it because we are scared to be hegemonic? Is it because of our continued fear that if we do that, we'll be construed not different like apartheid? But I'm saying that our people are facing a threat that our neighbors are building a tunnel to access our economy via a back door. They don't have legislation. They don't have competition laws. But they sign an agreement that says we will deal with this particular aspect as we negotiate, and in fact, opening up a back door to your economy. In your view, in this case, Tim, as an intellectual, why do you think South Africa did not walk away from SACCO? There was a threat when the summit set in Botswana, when the meeting took place in Botswana. But why that threat was not seen through? What were the impediments for South Africa? Are we saying that our desire for unity exceeds our desire to survive as a country? I'll leave it to you as your last comments, Chief.
Honourable members, I know that we're sort of 8 minutes into your lunch. And
I'm sorry, the lunch is coming here, so there should not be one.
Oh, okay. All right. And what the presentation has done has elicited debate and discussion, and I'm learning as much from you as perhaps I put up here as well. Can I just speak about this word xenophobia very quickly? Unfortunately, it's a word that is misused and abused. And again, I'm sorry, we suffer from the same disease. It's called the non-thinking disease. We just don't think. I'm sorry. We adopt a phrase that somebody creates in a newspaper or on a press release, and all of a sudden xenophobia is a national characteristic of South Africa. Xenophobia etymologically means a fear of the outside. Phobia, fear, xeno, outside. It can mean a fear of outsiders. I don't see that. We, as a country, as a modern state, were built on migrant labor. we, there's no pure South African identity in South Africa. We don't. There's no such thing. There's no pure identity. Heaven's sakes. I mean, all our political leaders, all us as people, we're a melting pot. We, you know, so go back to Thabo Mbeki's "I'm an African." We try to think. Be careful about using this word xenophobia. Let's just look at what in fact is going on and stop absorbing words that others are creating for us that in fact then define us. And then all of a sudden our behavior patterns become that. Because if we do accept that we are riven by xenophobia, that is going to affect our policies. Our planning, home affairs, housing, reticulation, pensions, education, migration, foreign affairs is going to be strongly influenced by an acceptance or an endorsement that we are xenophobic, and that the message coming out from our people is that we are xenophobic and we don't want foreigners. So I think we have to be very careful about that. Honorable Moore, China and Gaddafi and so on, I did make some mention of it. You know, the Chinese complain, is too strong a word, but they do make the point, and it's well made, that they are perfectly clear about what their objectives are in and with Africa, and that Africa is far less clear. And it just goes to the original point, 53 to 54 different national perspectives that tend not to speak together on these issues. And that's another factor or force that should compel or propel us to greater unity or greater commonality of vision, particularly when we're dealing with large economic or trading blocks. That's one reason for unity. Frankly, the role of Muammar Gaddafi, I think, is mixed. I think he has a particular political agenda, and he's prepared to fund that political agenda. And clearly, he's operated in Zimbabwe, and Zimbabwe has securitized some of its production to pay for the facilities that it ordinarily could not get on the international market. So that's been one element of Gaddafi's economic diplomacy, if I can put it that way. There are other less sanguine aspects to his diplomacy or activities that I think are quite dangerous with regard to fundamentalism, historically. There's a slide missing from my presentation, and it's my fault, because it covers these, or at least it mentions notions of tribalism, ethnicity, race, a whole culture, whole questions, no answers, but questions. Because, frankly, our continent since 1945, but more particularly since 1957, has been one that's largely been defined by underdevelopment and by conflict during the 1960s and 1970s and the 1980s. However, that doesn't determine that I'm not convinced that is because our politics is driven by tribalism or ethnicity. I don't buy that argument at all. Because then how would you explain a peaceful country like Ghana? It has ethnic groups. It has religious divisions. It has traditional divisions. Yet it's largely, admittedly, with a few coups, it's been a peaceful country with a couple of exceptions up north. It lives in peace and harmony. Cote d'Ivoire, until quite recently, was a peaceful country. So I think that what you found and what we're looking at is this question of resources, exacerbation of the access to resources. I think notions in Collier's terms of greed and grievance have played themselves out. Let's not underestimate global competition, the Cold War, a scramble for Africa. But I have to say, we've also been the victims of appalling political leadership, kleptocratic states, appalling leadership, liberation movements that have been unsuccessful in converting themselves into democratic, legitimate governments that have used and abused their positions of power at the expense of nation states and the populace, and have been the allies of foreign powers, be they left, right, or center. So I think it's a combination of those things. It doesn't take us any further. What I can say is that the patterns have been increasingly favorable with regard to these things. Honorable Joe Ceremani, question about introspection, and I think that was the original slide, Honorable Ceremani. It's exactly that slide. It was, there is insufficient introspection. There's insufficient interrogation at all levels. And I happen to believe that whereas the political elites will debate and discuss these issues and come to some form of agreement, our parliaments do not sufficiently. And I mean our African parliaments. Because as most of you know, spent the last 6 years or so researching and working with and attempting to strengthen our parliaments. And many of our parliaments are disengaged. It reinforces the point of Honourable Hajej. So the debate has to take place not just at the elite level, within parliaments, but within civil society. And then we need to talk in a vertically integrated way. We have to be frank and honest about when there is a conflict in Kenya after the December elections, and it cleaves along not just political lines, party political lines, but it cleaves along what appear to be ethnic lines, then we're either going to get into a position of denial, or we're going to say that's a reality under certain circumstances. If you have manufactured or engineered certain privileges within particular communities, you've allocated certain land, certain priorities, you've arrogated to yourself certain political privilege, military, police, security privilege, that is a license for conflict. In other words, I don't for one minute, I don't think there's any evidence that tribe, an adherence or an identification with a given tribe immutably and invariably and inevitably leads to conflict. But where you exacerbate those differences, where you superimpose material interests, relative deprivation, notions of greed and notions of grievance, that's where the recipe is particularly strong. Okay. Honorable Suramani, the question of child soldiers, I think it's something that we haven't looked enough at. We haven't looked enough at human trafficking, exploitation, and child soldiers are part of that phenomenon too. We need to look at that. It's one thing to have our borders open. It's another thing to have those borders open to unscrupulous predators. And child soldiers are linked to that sort of phenomenon too as well. In terms of our cultural practices, I think we must be careful. We must be careful not to be, on the one hand, politically correct to deny that we have these differences as opposed to enjoying our diversity as our national emblem and our national crest exemplifies. And that's where I think the Pan-African Parliament can play a fantastic role. I think it has the potential to become a... People dismiss the Pan-African Parliament as a chamber that really has no legislative power. That's absolutely fine because it's an invaluable chamber to have parliamentarians find their voice, to share ideas, to grow with each other, to have a demonstration effect, how can it be done, and to bring those ideas back into national parliaments and to transfer them back into communities as well. I'm running on a bit, I'm sorry, and I will be very, very quick now in the debate. What's the bottom line? Well, this is from Honourable Camara. The bottom line for African unity, it can be made very, very clearly indeed. Number one, we need to convert Africa into an internally integrated trading bloc. It needs to be a commercial, economic, and trading bloc within itself. It's a Nigerian case writ large. Nigeria is not a great trading nation. It exports petroleum, because then imports refined product. But internally, it has a massive internal market. We don't use that. We don't use the potential. We don't build and create the structures and the potential to create, if you like, a common market. And that's exactly where the strength of the EU came from. A common market. That's in the first instance. And that will require a whole host of things. But it does require infrastructure. That's the bottom line there. Second bottom line, security. We have to develop architecture that says to our brothers and sisters across the continent, if your country is threatened, perhaps not even externally but internally, or increasingly by rebel forces that are often funded by external factors and forces, that we will have facilities, structures in place to protect you, your citizens, work with you, not only to prevent this, but to reconcile these conflicts. Peacekeeping is very, very important. Thirdly, in a globalized world, we have to negotiate en masse and as a bloc as well. We have to exercise more collective power as a bloc. And that means control of our resources. That means greater control of our natural resources. I'm not calling necessarily for resource nationalism, but how we manage those resources, be it gold, platinum, timber, fisheries, our own water, as we get into periods of water stress, and we're not doing it. Our coastlines are being raped. And we don't even know, even if we have an economic exclusion zone, too many countries in Africa see that as an opportunity to issue licenses and have no monitoring capacity and no enforcement capacity as well. So unity, certain issues lend themselves to regional unity and possibly Pan-African unity as well. Carl-Junfe, Comrade Ben's comments there are well made and well taken, but at the same time, if you if the architecture that we are putting in place is not working well, it needs to be examined. Yes, there will be informal processes, and yes, this is going to be a messy process. That's absolutely fine. But we're the ones that set the targets. We did the blueprint. We set all the parameters ourselves. That was one of the joys of NetPad. It was designed by ourselves, implemented to some degree by ourselves. And likewise with the AU, the design of the AU. We've set those timelines. Agreed, they're unrealistic, but we set them and we need to interrogate them as well. Just in a comment on the internet, I mentioned that internet connectivity is improving. If Comrade Ben was here right now, I would say to him, you cannot transport people, timber, wood, petroleum, minerals through the internet. Not yet, maybe one day. So whilst we are a largely resource-based continent, in order to maximize and to begin to beneficiate those resources, we need hard infrastructure as well. His comment about intellectuals is well made and well taken, and once I meet an intellectual, I'll have a word with him or her. I don't know where they are. I think they're getting paid to do work by the World Bank, to be honest. Sadly, what's happening to our thinking class in South Africa is that it has become contract labor. They have a degree of tenure in South African universities, or they become contract labor. And they've paid euros and they've paid dollars. And they work for the highest bidder. And it's understandable. But I do think that our intellectual capital, in that sense, is being orientated to those that are paying the checks. And those that are paying the checks are the donor countries. It is the North. It is Europe, the United States, Scandinavia, etc. And understandably so. But that's where our intellectual capital is going. And I'm not sure that it's being invested in our students. Far too many academics in this country view university as a base on which to contract work outside. And our students suffer. I'm being very critical now, but I've been there. Students suffer. They're not available. They're not teaching. They're not dedicated to teaching. And they are not enriching our debate. What they're doing is responding to the next contract, the next tender that's coming out, the next... I will leave it there. There's a lot to be said for that. Dr. Peter Mulder, I don't have a huge response to that. I think he's right about the ambiguity about globalization, but also the proliferation of states. It's fascinating how stable Africa's borders have been since independence. They are remarkably stable. One is almost anticipating Nigeria to fall apart in 1967-68. One's anticipating that Zaire, Congo would fall apart. One's anticipating that Cote d'Ivoire could fall apart. It's very hard to see a state in Africa whose borders have been changed or that the nation state has fallen apart. It may be becoming a failed state in terms of its ability to govern or not. But we've been very strict and very rigid about our borders, even where they're profoundly artificial and being drawn by colonial powers as well. I was encouraged by Honorable Hajej's sober, experienced insider's comments, that is to say, it's a process. And I think the more that we have that debate, and I'm sorry, it's not for me to say it, but the more that we have this type of debate from insiders, parliamentarians that have got a pan-African and a regional perspective that can place these issues in perspective, I'm much more encouraged by that. I'm not encouraged by timelines that we miss, that are unrealistic, that no one really debated or signed off on, or we have no means of ensuring, like a roadmap, the Middle Eastern roadmap, that people comply with both the given parameters. What we need to view it as is a process, and it goes to Comrade Ben Turok's comment that it'll be messy, but we need to keep it moving forward realistically as well. Sure, Moore's gone. And then very challenging questions from the chair about the EPAs. And Honorable Sitoli, could I say that I too am perplexed by South Africa's position on this, but I do feel that I think you've put your finger on two critical points. I do not for 1 minute think that EPAs are a new form of colonization of Africa in that sense at all. But I do think that they shift the economic dynamic between the EU and Africa or developing states quite significantly. I think that they do, and it's more than nomenclature, it's more than discourse. It shifts the nature of the economic relationship quite significantly. And one of the issues that has blocked them in a sense, I think, is South Africa's maturity is the wrong word, but I think South Africa holding a particular line on the EPAs. That has been the critical issue. Unfortunately, it has isolated South Africa, or I don't think we're responsible for our own isolation, but the net effect is that we've become increasingly isolated. And indeed, it looks like side deals are being done almost behind our back. It's a challenge and it's a threat. And the only thing I can undertake to do is that we at SIRE, I mean, I'm sure there are many, many organizations that research this, but we do have a research unit at SIRE that deals with EU-Africa and development through trade. It's done a lot of work on the EPAs. And what I will undertake to do for honorable members is to gather together our research on this, send it through to you if you would like to disseminate it, and if there's any, there's a point that you would like us to come and talk to you about it in far more detail rather than just at the level of political discourse, we'd be delighted to do so. That's an open invitation. So I'm backing out of it insofar as the technical detail, I really don't have enough knowledge as far as that is concerned. Politically, I think your point is very, very well made. But an open invitation, SIRE will present to you and send their research to you on this, which I think generally accords with your sentiments too. And finally, to thank you for your time again.
Thank you, Tim. We will definitely follow up that offer. I think it's very important. Maybe just to take also the opportunity that the committee will be dealing. I don't have the dates yet, but we'll be dealing with China-South Africa relations very soon. If you could pass over some research work that you have done, we'll be dealing with China relations. We are looking at different scenarios of how we want to handle that, so that we can look at that. Also, that meeting could be over 2 days. We are planning that meeting that it could be over 2 days, because we want to look at South Africa, China, but within the context of the African continent. Go through all the other issues that affect our relationship with China. This is our 10th year of diplomatic relations with China. So as part of that situation, we want to do a comprehensive review. So we'll appreciate if you guys have something that you can pass over in preparation for those meetings. We are working on it. We're working very tirelessly to get that, and probably we'll come back to you because we are intending to pursue the idea of looking at the South African foreign policy in the last 15 years, to say to what extent have we been able to place our foreign policy at the center of our engagement with the world, and how has the world responded to that foreign policy objectives, and how have we been able to respond to ourselves to the challenges, and how we want to deal with those issues. So those are two critical issues that are still coming. We hope to pull up those meetings also over a period of 2 days, just before we adjourn. And we hope that we'll then open up that meeting to other people who may want to contribute and give us a critical assessment of how they see us having done in terms of dealing with our foreign policy. As a Committee of Foreign Affairs, we are interested to see to what extent have we been able ourselves as a committee to do an oversight over the implementation of that policy, and to what extent have we been able to influence that policy. So we are working on that, and want to look at how we best do that. Comrade Hajjaj, you...
I just wanted to make a request. If it's possible, and if you have some research on the AU-EU strategy, I think I'd appreciate, I'm sure the committee will appreciate that sort of research coming from SIRE.
We will probably be also sometime in the next meeting or so look at the
there was a report that has been done by for the EU to look at its institutional mechanism. So we'll be having a briefing as a follow-up to this, to look at the EU critically. Not the EU, AU, critically, to see whether its structure in this form and the weaknesses identified are they themselves an impediment to the unity of the continent. To what extent has the AU ability or inability affected the unity of the continent? And then be able to move that process forward. We think that this is a debate that we need to pursue, particularly with us under these challenges. We need to engage this unity concept. What does it mean? Does it mean that we preach unity here and then I go out and I beat all nations, foreign nationals, and I come back here and say, ah, no, unity. It's quite a challenge. But of course, those of us who have been driving around all the affected areas, we probably hold a different view as to what people are saying on the ground. They themselves are, when we are an actor, but you yourself are confused about the fact of your own action, that those actions are subscribed to something else that you, as an actor, don't even know. That's what we find out when we visit. And they said, but why do you guys say that we are xenophobic? Why do you say that? Because this has nothing to do, it has to do with so and so, because of this and that and that and that. This has nothing to do with any xenophobic behavior that we read and we hear about it. These are the people that are supposed to be affected. Yeah. As Zimbabwean who addressed us said, we don't think that we are subject of xenophobia. We think that we are subject of something else. We're just on the right time, on the right place, and we're attacked because of different things that has nothing to do with us. And when you look at it, when you went to Rehe Park, you found South African women who are there, who have been evicted from their houses, conscious that they are South Africans. They might be subject of xenophobia from their fellow South Africans, I don't know. In Alex, we're told that the first victim that was killed was a Zulu-speaking person. But the police said to us, we think that the environment provided a space for this person to be killed. This person was going to be killed, but we think these guys did not know how to do it. So when this thing happened, they went straight to his house and said, Mr. Strala, open. He opened, he was shot. And then when the wife and the kids ran away, and he managed to run away, he was followed and finished off. And when he was finished off, then it was said to xenophobia. We don't know. We'll hear the report when the task team presented in Parliament. But it's quite scary. And we said to the media when we were there, said, talk to the communities. Before you write, just talk to people who are involved. Let them tell you exactly what is happening. In one community, they said to us, a bus came to drop people in that area, and those people called a meeting of all South Africans to come in, and they addressed them to say, no, we need to deal with it. The community said, in the next minute, you disappear here, or we moor a hell out of you. And those guys ran away. So they went to areas where they knew that they would be able to do that. Is that xenophobia? Are South Africans xenophobic? I've always maintained that we're never and we are not xenophobic. We have challenges and we need to deal with them. We have a report that we compiled with the Human Rights Commission 2 years ago dealing with this subject. And I've asked, in fact, that they should pull up that report. Because some of the issues that are happening today are some of the issues that we've managed to identify then to be challenges. Honourable members, I'm told that your lunch is getting cold. The secretary is looking at me in the eye. So we can eat.
Thank you very much.